I know why I hear nothing. I had not pushed on my microphone. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, and you did not know that because I had not pushed my microphone on. It is Thursday, January 16th. A little bit about the weather out there. Snowy, heavy snow. And of course, I was up at 6 o'clock in the morning shoveling that heavy snow. So by noon today, I'm totally exhausted. Last night was riveting TV, I have to admit. We'd heard that Rachel Maddow was going to have an interesting guest on her show. She did have an interesting guest on her show. And we were all listening to the comments of Parnas last night. And I tell you, covering this administration is so challenging. You don't know where the truth begins. You don't know where the lies end. It is just going to be – it's going to be a very, very difficult 2020 campaign. I'm just telling you right now, how do you run against someone who has no affinity for facts or the truth? I don't know how you do it because it's kind of like punching in a balloon and it pops out the other side. So I saw an article at Salon.com, everyone. And joining us right now on the line is the author of this article, Keith Spencer. Keith, this is such an important article. And what you don't know is I had a conversation on TV last night and I didn't realize how much this article was going to play in my head. The title of your piece is Why Solve Climate Change When You Can Monetize It? Congress slips in a little bit of cash to fund geoengineering as part of a larger ploy. And Keith, why don't you share with my audience your job at Salon.com and a little bit about your history, and then I'll tell you about the conversation I had last night on television and why it's really important that we understand what you wrote about now.
Sure thing. So I'm a senior editor at Salon.com, and I manage the coverage of science, tech, and labor. Mm-hmm. And yeah, before this, I also an author. I wrote a book that came out about a year and a half ago that was called People's History of Silicon Valley. Huh. So I think what I sort of, you know, made my career on is being sort of the cultural and social critic of technology and science. Wow. I studied, I have a degree in physics.
Okay.
And I used to do physics research too. So I have a sort of background in science. And come from a family of scientists, but I'm very, you know, interested in sort of the ways that the rhetoric of technology and the rhetoric of science kind of like trickle in and relate to things happening politically. And
yeah. I genuflect to your science background because it makes it very helpful as you then pick up pen and paper, or in this case, you know, your laptop, sure. And you take that knowledge and you put it into a way that we can understand, and you can also dissect when the BS is coming at you because you're so well versed in the science that they can't
definitely,
which is valuable. So last night I was on the air with a state representative from New Hampshire. And his name is Bob Backus. He's a phenomenal environmentalist. He is frightened beyond belief about climate change. And he and his committee had passed a carbon tax and dividend bill.
Yeah.
And obviously he knows that we really need to sort of have sustainable energy. We need to change all our behaviors. But a lot of people are thinking that, you know, maybe this is one arrow that we can use to deal with it. And the more important thing isn't just to tax carbon, but then the question is, what do you do with the revenues that you raise from it? And of course, the people that will be most harmed by a carbon tax tend to be the low income, you know, and especially in New Hampshire where it's very rural. And so the rationale was that they were going to be one of the first states, if not the first state, to actually pass a carbon tax, and that they were going to sort of lead the way, and they were going to talk about this dividend and do the dividend in a very progressive way so that the people that would be most harmed by the tax would also be invested in this, similar to what we've seen happen in places like Canada, unlike what Macron did not quite understand when he forced his carbon tax and saw the result. So he was devastated and said it was one of the worst days ever for him in the New Hampshire legislature because it was his Democratic leadership that pushed back. Because they said, we can't do anything like this because they're going to frame it as a tax. They're going to say we're anti-business. We cannot do this. And he looked at them and said, and when do we start being aggressive about climate change? And when do we start risking what they're going to call us by understanding they are risking our future and the planet?
Yeah.
And he was just, I mean, he was almost on the verge of tears because he says, I don't even know who I'm fighting anymore. I thought these were my allies. And they were actually mouthing the opposition better than them.
Right.
So this story that you wrote to me seemed so much part of the challenge and the problem. So let's talk about what was slipped into this funding bill and explain to us the term geoengineering and why we should fear it.
Right. So basically, in the big spending package that, you know, that Congress passed, and this is late December, so just a few weeks ago, you know, it's like a I believe it's overall, it's like, you know, $1.4 trillion.
Right.
Yeah, it's a lot of money. And so there was just $4 million in there, which is, you know,
nothing.
It's not that much, but, mm-hmm. if you're a scientist or a scientific agency, it's a bit of cash for a few people to study something. So in it says that there's $4 million to study modeling and assessments and observe Earth's stratosphere and what they call the radiation budget, which has to do with how much of the radiation of the sun hits, you know, the atmosphere and comes in and how much leaves.
Mm-hmm.
And basically to study the upper atmosphere and to sort of study, also to study proposals to figure out, you know, to do geoengineering, which in this case is sort of related to, you know, there's things we can do to the atmosphere that might reflect more sunlight or block some of the sunlight that would hit Earth and thus cool the planet a little bit.
So this is like, we're not going to look at root causes. We're not going to address why we have created this problem. We're going to look at the problem and say, so how do we reduce this problem? Not by going from the bottom, but by doing this engineering and looking at the top and saying, well, maybe we can sort of deflect the sun, or maybe we can do this, not realizing how do we get here?
Right, exactly. Yeah. So then to ask your question about, so what geoengineering is largely is it's just sort of this term that refers to ways that, you know, human engineers could directly do different, like math, you know, large scale engineering schemes that would affect, that would change the planet as a whole. So, you know, some of us are sort of familiar with this term, or it's related to terraforming. Like sometimes you hear people talk about terraforming Mars, you know, to make it habitable or something. So that would be like a large scale geoengineering plan on another planet. But on Earth, you know, I mean, arguably you could say that burning fossil fuels is an indirect form of geoengineering, and that it wasn't really intentional when people started, you know, burning coal, you know, way back hundreds of years ago. They weren't thinking, oh, that we're going to, you know, this is a part of a 300-year plan to warm Earth. Like, no one was thinking that directly. But, you know, but you can, I mean, scientists and technologists are smart and have figured out there are things you can do to, you know, reduce the amount of sunlight on Earth to cool Earth a little bit.
Right.
Which you know, and so as you know, the problem we have is that we're burning too many fossil fuels and there's too much CO2 in the atmosphere, and to some extent other pollutants like, you know, NO2 and methane and particularly and things like that. But so, you know, the most obvious thing to most of us would be, well, you know, we should, like, trees over time sap up. Trees in the ocean over time can sap up that CO2. I mean, so you could,
and
you
farmers could farmers could plant things that also absorb the carbon. So there are things to do that are not necessarily geoengineering, but they would in fact be the carbon capture. Only it's not sexy and sophisticated, and you don't make a lot of profit on it.
Right. Yeah. So you don't make as much money. I mean, so people who like to monetize these things don't make as much money if you do sort of some type of big Keynesian Green New Deal project where you have a lot of people with new government jobs to help, you know, clean pollutants and things like that. So it was just, what I think was so interesting about the bill is that it kind of reflects the shift in, you know, what you might call like the way that the ruling class, or particularly the GOP, thinks about climate change, which is like, you know, I mean, like, for years, the line from a lot of Republicans generally has been, no, climate change isn't real, or it's a joke, or whatever. But, you know, we know internally that people who work directly with a lot of politicians know, you know, like the sort of people that fund Republican campaigns are very aware that it's a real thing. I mean, you can't run like an oil company without being aware of what you're doing.
You can't live in Miami. I mean, I hate to break it to you, but, you know.
You can't live in Miami.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
You probably have heard, are familiar with this, and your listeners too. But you know, like Exxon and some of the other big oil companies, you know, they had their scientists knew for decades what was going on.
Oh yeah,
like very very intricately. Like they were very aware of this problem because it's their job to be aware of what, you know, their fossil fuels are doing to the world. So I think what was so interesting about it was it kind of signifies a shift where we've gone from, you know, oh, climate change isn't real, it doesn't exist, to sort of like, well, let's just not actually solve the problem by changing the economy to be less carbon intensive and having some sort of, you know, massive shift in massive sort of social civilizational shift that would fix this, but instead let's monetize this and let's just do these short term fixes. We don't have to actually change anything. I mean, it's sort of very typical for this type of short term thinking that you know, corporations are sort of akin to, since it's hard for them to think beyond the next quarter or something like, you know, something like that. And so, you know, what I talk about a bit in the article is that there are a lot of sort of smaller tech companies and startups that want to be, you know, they want to get these huge government contracts to, you know, have like factories that take carbon out of the air, like, or, you know, be part of these geoengineering things. Like they would have planes full of things like, so sulfur dioxide is one that's often touted. So sulfur dioxide is when sulfur dioxide molecules get to the upper atmosphere, they reflect more sunlight. When there's big volcanic explosions, it's one of the big byproducts and it can cool the earth for a couple of years. The problem is they don't last that long in the upper atmosphere, so you would have to keep spraying the upper atmosphere again. And
that would be great from a profit model. As long as you keep needing me, then I can keep spraying, you know? And the whole idea is they don't actually want a solution. I think what you said is they want a subscription in the sense that a solution fixes something, and a subscription means you have to keep going back and going back and going back. I mean, it's kind of like the planned obsolescence, you know? Why have a machine that works when you can have a machine that breaks down every 2 years and then you can sell them a new one?
I know, yeah, and it's really, I think that's really fascinating. I mean, so I write about this a lot in other articles about the tech industry and how their model, and so I think most industries, if they can, they do this. They try to move to a rentier model. So,
a rentier, exactly.
And in our lifetime, we saw this happening in tech. Like when I was younger, you would buy music, right?
Mm-hmm.
And as I've gotten older, you just rent it. People don't really buy DVDs anymore. You just
never
rent
own
them.
It. Exactly. Exactly.
Like there's all these things that it's better to pay. If you pay for something, you know, like movie studios and music recording or music companies, like would rather that you just pay them every month.
Right.
For the rest of your life. Then buy the CD once.
Well, let me connect this to something we've talked a lot about on this program, and that is right to repair. I mean, that's part of the problem. I was just reading an article out in Iowa. You know what is the hottest selling piece of equipment in Iowa?
Old tractors,
30-year-old tractors that you can fix. I mean, what you don't know about me, you know what the first thing I ever learned to drive was a Farmall tractor from 1956. I mean, that was the first thing. But let me just say something. That Farmall tractor is still working. And you know why that Farmall tractor is still working? Because you can frickin' repair it. And because you actually owned it. You owned it. You knew where the parts were. You knew how to fix it. And that is what is so interesting. And this whole idea of right to repair is actually more important. It's about right to own. So when you actually buy something, it's yours. And it's not that you're always wedded to John Deere or whoever, who's the only one in the world that has the key to fix it. And so this whole idea about geoengineering. So let me push back a little, because I agree with you. My eyes roll when I realize this. And the whole idea is to have a Green New Deal. The whole idea is to embrace alternative energy. The whole idea is to embrace conservation. Frankly, the idea is to democratize energy. You know, if we can democratize it, which is what they hate about it, they don't want to democratize it because that means that they can't make money. Because if you can do it yourself, then you don't need them. And that's how they make their profit. So we were talking on the show yesterday about Australia. And the reason I want to bring up Australia is that it's really important for us to think this through. Australia's number one export is coal. All right.
Yeah.
Australia is burning. Australia has seen billions of animals die. They don't know whether they're going to ever be able to put out the fires. They also know that they are seeing in real life the climate crisis is now for them. It is not 5 years from now. It's not 2050, 2030. It is yesterday. Okay. So they are living this and they've had lots of climate deniers that they elected. Their prime minister is a climate denier. But part of the reason is that it is so connected to the economy of Australia. And that because they are so wedded to coal, anything that challenges the superiority of coal is something that just cannot be accepted in Australia because it is the baseline for their economy. But part of the problem is that the people that are pushing the idea that they need to get off the coal teat, they have to change their position, is that even if they decided tomorrow to get rid of every coal mine, to switch over to alternatives, they will still cook in Australia.
Yeah.
That it won't change the burning, that it won't change the atmosphere. They are part of a planet-wide problem. And yes, they are contributing to making it worse, but the problem is making it worse still means it's crap now. It's bad today. Right. So how do we talk about, you know, addressing the future by making sure that we begin to look to alternatives, change our behavior, democratize our energy, basically say to the fossil fuel companies, I'll buy you if you really want the frickin' profit. I just don't want you to exist. But also know that in that temporary time between now and whatever, there may be some reason for some variation on geoengineering, because this is not a switch. You don't fix the climate by everyone doing the right thing tomorrow, because we'll still cook.
Right. Well, you know, so to speak to what, to your first point there about, you know, so, right, a lot of people have jobs that are very reliant on a sort of carbon-intensive economy.
Right.
So coal, for instance.
Yeah.
So, This I think is a really interesting point that is underappreciated, which is that this connects to another sort of facet of progressive politics and policy proposals for a long time, and that is the idea of a right to a job. And this type of policy proposal, actually, it wouldn't just be good for sort of helping people who are, you know, are worried about losing their job or something because of this transition, right?
Right.
But so like Bernie Sanders has proposed this, for instance, like, you know, the government can provide lots of jobs, and it's good for, you know, like historically.
We did it after the Great Depression. I mean, we have a model for this.
Yeah. Depression. Yeah.
Right.
So like, I mean, imagine, but so like, just even beyond the coal, I mean, if everybody had sort of a right to a job in some way, then you would have less of an incentive to dig your heels in and be like, you know, well, I need this job. Same as something like a universal health care.
Right.
Because in the United States, at least, not other countries are like this, but your job is often tied to your ability to access health care.
Right.
So if everybody's basic needs are sort of covered in this way, that is, you know, they are, you know, in most like welfare states in Europe, for instance, then you lose this incentive to dig that actually literally changes people's politics if they feel like their job is threatened. But the other side effect of having some sort of job guarantee would also be that I'm sure that plenty of your listeners have worked in, you know, this happens often in large companies where there's people whose jobs become useless, but they continue to work at the company in sort of a sinecure, not doing that much because, you know, they're afraid that there's no incentive to speak up and be like, hey, like, I'm just wasting everyone's time and money being here.
Exactly.
You don't want that to happen. And like, I've worked places where there's people who it's like, you know, I'm never going to say like, hey, this person's job's obsolete now because that's their livelihood.
Right.
But I think we would have a much more efficient economy too, just in terms of labor distribution, if everybody was like, well, you know, I'll be fine no matter what happens, so I'm not going to stay here, but also
the idea of right to a job, and again, I'm going to go back to what they did after the Great Depression. I mean, it created the Tennessee Valley Authority. We were able to actually then take all these individuals who needed a job, we gave them a job, but then we were able to step back sort of collectively and say, what do we need as a country? What kinds of infrastructure do we need to invest in?
Right.
What kind of alternatives? So that it's not just that you are saying you get a job, but you can look at what are the consequences of that job. Is the job to provide a profit for a ExxonMobil, or is the job a way to be able to sort of plan with a sense of generational ethics that you'll have a future because you're addressing climate change? I had this dream, and I'm going to run it by you since you write for Salon.com. Mm. There's a program in education, and it's called Reading Recovery. And reading recovery is you don't have to label a kid as special ed. What you have to do is you look at the bottom 20% of all the readers and you spend your time, energy, and money in making them better readers. Okay? Mm. So they don't have to be labeled. You just look at the bottom and you say, how do I bring them up? And that means that every year you're sort of changing the nature of who reads and who reads well, because you're constantly bringing the bottom up in order for them not to need your services. And then everyone becomes a better reader and everyone gets to graduate from high school, yada, yada, yada. I want to do something like an energy recovery. I want to look at the most inefficient businesses, houses, government structures in the state, in the country, and say, how do we address that bottom 20%? What can we do for them to make them more efficient? What can we do for them to slap solar panels on their roof? What can we do for them? And do it generically so that it's in every state. It's a business. It's a school. It's a home. And therefore, by looking at that, what you've done is you've changed their future dramatically. You've employed millions of people. And at the same time, you're constantly making your economic society better.
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. That's sort of an excellent kind of like policy proposal rationale that would also, you know, is sort of progressive from below, right? I mean, it starts
at the bottom. Exactly. And it's a win-win because when part of the group that seems to be the most knee-jerk in opposition to climate change are people who are at the lower end of the economic spectrum. I mean, that was the whole point of the carbon tax. Well, if you live in rural New Hampshire and you drive a gas-guzzling whatever, and suddenly they're telling you that you have to pay more in this carbon tax, they're going to say, screw you, even though the end, it's harmful for them because it's undermining their future. So I think it's in an interesting way, it's also about framing. And the problem is, you know, conservatives have been so good at framing the fear. We haven't been good at framing the solution.
Yeah. That's absolutely true.
So as you see this, I guess I got to ask, so how do we fight back and explain to people that this is the better choice over the long run? I read a story yesterday that, you know, billionaires and ExxonMobil and the frackers have been spending $1 billion a year misinforming us, lying to us, creating the impression that there really either isn't a climate crisis or only they have a solution. Mm-hmm. How do you fight that?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, as we were both talking about before, this narrative framing works really well. I mean, I think there's a reason that for instance, we were talking about just how all these different sort of universal social programs are actually, you know, they may not seem like they're part of stopping climate change, but they can be, or they are in a larger sense, like things like Medicare for all and this jobs guarantee idea, right? I mean, if in a sort of society where people have their basic needs met and they're not for want of healthcare or education or debt, there's more freedom for them to, you know, feel more secure in their careers. And like if you have been working in an oil field your whole life and you know that you can go get a free education and retrain your skills or whatever and that you'll be provided for while you do it, it's really not going to probably feel as daunting as it would in this type of, you know, in our current sort of, you know, lack of social safety net where somebody in that situation would be totally out of luck. Is you could sort of see that in the Rust Belt. And the reason the Rust Belt exists in the first place is because we don't have good ways of retraining, you know, people's skills that they can actually take time off from life and do that because you need to survive and there's no other jobs there and there's no jobs guaranteed.
And this is a conversation I'm going to need to let you go, Keith, but what's so interesting to me is the northern part of my state used to have paper mills. And a lot of my environmentalists were so excited when the mills left. And I said, I'm not. And it's not because I wasn't concerned about the environmental consequences of the mills. My concern was, what do those people do for a living when the mills go? And so part of the problem has been is that environmentalists for the longest time haven't looked at the gestalt. They know their piece of the conversation. They want to fix the environment. They're not looking at the human consequences of fixing that environment. And if we had addressed 30 years ago or 40 years ago those human consequences as we talked about protecting the environment, we would have been in a better position today than we are. And unfortunately, we've been finding people with lots of profits who've been able to sort of manipulate our knowledge. But if we had understood you can't protect the environment without protecting the human environment of raising a family, finding shelter, and being able to have a future. And if you don't look at that piece as well, then you actually haven't protected the environment.
Right.
All you've done is create. Yeah, it's just amazing. Thank you so much for writing this. I'm glad that you pay attention to the budget the way I don't. Keith Spencer writes for Salon.com. His piece was entitled, Why Solve Climate Change When You Can Monetize It? Oh, my God. Thank you so much. We'll talk to you again, I'm sure.
Yes. Thank you, Arnie.
All right. Ciao. Bye-bye. All right, everyone. This is The Attitude. A little labor history is next.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1946. That was the day the United Packing House Workers of America went on strike. Their initial demand was for a 25-cent-an-hour raise. They were also joined in the strike by the Amalgamated Meat Cutters Union. The action was part of a massive wave of walkouts after World War II that included steel and auto workers. Frustrated that wartime profits had not benefited working people, unions across multiple industries were on the march. According to historian Roger Horowitz, the United Packing House Workers of America's strike was supported by an overwhelming membership vote of 20-1. For 3 months before the strike, the membership prepared. The strike was planned with the strategy of strong local rank-and-file organizing. Membership was encouraged to participate in mass pickets, as well as in building community support for the action. This grassroots organizing proved a successful tactic. The strike cut meat production across the country by 50%. The Brooklyn Daily Eagle headline declared, "Rush on meat as strike cuts supply." The newspaper described how 300 women had stormed one marketplace to purchase meat before it ran out. Alarmed by the consumer shortages, President Harry S. Truman stepped in. On the 10th day of the strike, by the authority of the War Labor Disputes Act, he ordered the workers back to their jobs. President Truman ordered a commission to study their demands. In the end, the commission awarded the workers a 16-cent-an-hour raise. Although it fell short of the quarter-an-hour demand, it was the largest increase ever won in the industry. It was also the first successful strike by the meatpacking workers. The workers had shown how local solidarity could demonstrate the power of labor. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In many California cities, housing is prohibitively expensive.
Our urban areas are so expensive that people working in those job centers are being pushed further and further out.
Kate Gordon is director of the California Governor's Office of Planning and Research. She says as the cost of city living has increased, more houses have been built in outlying areas of the state. They're often near forests, grasslands, or other natural areas, so they're at higher risk of burning when wildfires spread.
What we call the wildland-urban interface, which is the sort of high fire risk areas of the state, are getting more and more populated, in part because of people commuting really long distances.
So Gordon says that as climate change increases the threat of intense wildfires, it's important to address urban sprawl. Last year, California allocated $500 million to encourage high-density residential construction in urban areas. The money will go toward building sidewalks, bus stops, parks, and other amenities that support city living. She says by prioritizing affordable urban housing, the state can help reduce further sprawl into fire-prone areas. That would shorten commute times, and it could save lives. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
I smell a rat, baby. Smell a rat, baby. You better watch out. I smell a rat, baby. You won't tell me where you've been. Whiskey running all down the chin. I smell a rat, baby. I smell a rat, baby.
I think that should be our theme song. Every time Donald Trump's face shows up or a tweet comes out, I want to start playing I Smell a Rat Baby. So who sings I Smell a Rat Baby? Buddy Guy? Is that what I see? Buddy Guy. Wow. Phenomenal. Phenomenal. Well, we're not going to be talking to a rat. That's the good news. The good news is who's joining us as he does every Thursday is Stefan Schmidt. Stefan Schmidt is known affectionately as Dr. Politics. He is a professor of political science at Iowa State. He has been covering the caucus and the primary for decades and decades. He has the best-selling political science textbook in the United States, everyone, just to let you know. So I just want people to be impressed. But the I Smell a Rat Baby. Let me just say something, Stefan. I posted something on Facebook, and it's a perfect beginning for this conversation. And what I posted on Facebook had to deal with what I heard last night with Lev Parnas on the Rachel Maddow show. I'm sure you caught it. And what I said was the following. I said, isn't it exciting? Ukraine has decided to start an investigation. And I'm like, whoa, but it's not an investigation of Hunter and Joe Biden. It is an investigation of whether Ambassador Yanukovych, or whatever her name is, was in fact being surveilled in the Ukraine. And they are outraged that someone would actually do that to the American ambassador. So in a lot of ways, this has come back to bite Donald Trump in the proverbial you-know-what. Welcome to the program, Stefan.
Squeak, squeak. Is that what rats do? I don't
remember.
Yeah,
they do squeak.
We have mice in my farmhouse. Luckily, no rats. But I was absolutely fascinated, as you were, with that particular revelation, because then deeper than that, there is this person who was a supporter, is a supporter of President Trump. I think he's a landscaper.
Running for Congress in Florida.
Yeah, they have a picture with him at Mar-a-Lago or somewhere. And this fellow also was involved here, sandwiched between Giuliani and the Ukrainians and who knows who else. And the things that he said really sound to me
threatening,
like he was looking for someone in Ukraine to fulfill a contract on Ambassador Yanukovych. I mean, it just sounds like a mafia thing. And if they don't follow up on this, and if the FBI doesn't go after this and see, you know, what was in, intended there, I will be so disappointed, because that's the limit. That's where really, really dangerous behavior begins. And you know, with all the stuff that's going on, it may sort of slide by, but I hope it doesn't, because that's really the most interesting thing that's come out of this.
Well, but that's why it is really an interesting political move on the part of the Ukraine to make a decision to open up an investigation. And it's not into something that Donald Trump wants or the Republicans want. It's an investigation into the surveillance. Let me just read you the article from BuzzFeed. Ukrainian authorities said Thursday they had opened a criminal investigation into whether former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, Maria Yanukovych, whatever her name is, was under surveillance by associates of Rudy Giuliani while in Kyiv last spring. Officials from Ukraine's Interior Ministry announced the investigation in a televised briefing, citing a trove of documents released by House Democrats on Tuesday that included several cryptic WhatsApp messages between Lev Parnas and Robert Hyde, which is what you're talking about, okay? But this is the part that I love, is what the Interior Minister said. Ready for this? Ukraine's position is to not interfere in the domestic affairs of the United States. Now, listen to this. However, the published records contain the fact of a possible violation of the legislation of Ukraine and the Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations, which protects the rights of a diplomat on the territory of another country. We cannot ignore such illegal activities on its territories. Oh, Stefan, look at how they framed it. I freaking love it. So here you are saying that the State Department and the CIA and the FBI, they should absolutely begin an investigation. But look who actually started an investigation within 24 hours of the release of that information. The one place that Donald Trump has been begging them to investigate, which is Ukraine. And what is their first investigation? Of the ambassador.
No, it is a kind
amazing
of twist that I think nobody expected. And certainly, you know that there is a lot of fury, sound and fury going on in the White House this morning. You know, you've got that incredible, interesting ceremony of delivering the impeachment articles, which some of the media, sarcastic, young, stupid, mocked. They said, what is this stupid thing with them marching through the House and going over to the Senate and delivering this?
Right.
I was so mad, because it's not a stupid ceremony. It is probably one of the most somber and important ceremonies in the United States, which is the beginning of a discussion as to whether the president of the United States should be removed. Don't make fun of it. You know, take it for what it is. We have so little serious and historic ceremony directly connected to the Constitution. I'm really, every day, I'm more and more disappointed in our media.
Well, and so, we're all glued to the TV last night. There's just no question about it. And there's, I'm of two minds because, you know, I've been manipulated before. And you want to believe what Parnas says because he feeds into everything I have that sort of makes me despise Donald Trump. It's like every checkbox he did, except what was interesting when it came to what was his name, Robert Hedge, whatever the crazy guy who supposedly was following Lev Parnas. But what he said was he doesn't believe it. He said he was perpetually drunk. All right, perpetually drunk, Robert Hyde. And as a result of the fact that he was perpetually drunk, he probably could have said something or created the illusion of something. The problem is, who do you believe? You know, and why would you take anything as the final word when you know that they removed her in the middle of the night and they said, we're worried about your safety? And she even asks the question, my personal safety? And so they said, well, we don't know, but you got to go now. Well, I hate to break it to you. The only reason why you have to go now and the only safety I could imagine would be personal safety. Am I right?
Of course. What else would it be?
Exactly.
I mean, the thing is that I seriously doubt that the Ukrainian government would have had the response to this and start an investigation like this if they thought that it was just some, you know, sort of nightmare of a drunk guy.
Right.
I mean, at some point you have to believe somebody. I agree with you. Who do you believe?
In the end, you
drill down deep enough so that you have compelling information as to who you should believe, you know?
No, but what was interesting is that part of what you hear from Robert Hayes, Hedge, what's his name? Robert Hyde.
Hyde.
I apologize.
Yeah.
He's a new name for me, so I'm trying to get accustomed to it.
Yeah, he's a new name for all of us.
Yeah, he's a new name for all of us. I know,
yes.
And maybe in a way by my not remembering it sort of reminds us how he is the new name. So we know that Robert was a fixture at Mar-a-Lago. We know that he's running for Congress. We know that he desperately wanted attention. He also understood what buttons to push, okay? And that's really what he was doing. And even in his drunken stupor, he knew that the ambassador and Ukraine was something that he needed to become more familiar with. But one of the things I find so interesting is the other reason why I think Ukraine responded to this is that one of the things that is being suggested is that you can buy anyone in Ukraine to do anything. And if you are trying to show the world that you are a different country, that this is not the Wild West, that you can't just hire any person to do a hit on someone, including the ambassador, that's another reason why they wanted to sort of investigate this, is they are saying that they are addressing corruption everywhere, including that concept.
And they're trying to debunk the notion that, you know, Ukraine is like a third world country where you can hire hitmen and kill people. Of course, you can hire hitmen in the United States, for that matter. But I understand. I wouldn't know, but I understand.
Yeah. So I want to get into a little bit about what happened with the debate. But actually, more than that, we are galloping to the caucus. And I am trying to explain to people how a caucus is different from a primary, which we have done on numerous occasions on this show, if not recently, but in the last couple of years.
Ad nauseum. But
you need to hold my hand. Can you tell me about the new rules for the Iowa caucus?
That's the
part I don't understand. So in a nutshell, really quickly, explain what the old rules were, how caucuses basically have been done historically, and what are we seeing with these new rules?
Well, in the previous caucus, the last one, 2016, Democrats, Republicans, you walk in, Republicans walk in, there are a few speeches made by some of the sort of political leaders that are there, they're precinct leaders or maybe county leaders, and then in the Republican one, you vote on a paper ballot, stick it in a box, they count those votes, and whoever got the most votes, you know, it's reported out. That's how Donald Trump and Ted Cruz came up in a tie, and then people can go home. In the Democratic one, you come in. There are all kinds of things going on. You then are called to order. Then they give you the rules and they say, okay, if you're supporting Bernie Sanders, go stand in that corner, Hillary Clinton in that corner. And,
then
they count and they say, well, you have to have 15% of the people at each precinct in order for that candidate to continue to
be
viable.
Right.
Yes, viable. Okay. And then they count at the end the results, and they do a mathematical formula for delegate equivalence, which nobody understands. I mean, even Albert Einstein said, I don't understand how this mathematics works here, because it's so complicated, because the guy who wrote that was a math and engineering graduate student at Iowa State back in 1972, I think.
Uh-huh.
And then they report it out, and it goes on. The new rule is, and you had to go to physically to the precinct where you live. So I have, in my little precinct here, I have to go, you know, to the conservation building where the caucus will be. And people said it's too difficult. Well, so what they were under pressure to change it. They were going to do basically virtual caucuses where people could participate from home and so on.
Yep.
Then there was this whole brouhaha about how, oh, that's not secure, the Russians can hack it, as if the Russians give a damn about the Iowa caucuses, frankly.
Well,
I mean, so maybe they do,
but maybe they do,
maybe they do, let's say they do. So they said, no, you can't do that. They said, okay, well, to make it more accessible, we're going to have the caucuses in each of the precincts, but we'll also have satellite caucuses in places where people, large numbers of people, or enough people, might be, like in England or in Switzerland.
Right.
Or
I have a friend who's in China, and he's participating in a satellite caucus in China, everyone. So An Iowa caucus in China. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Which is great. I like that. It's fine. And then the other rule, which is more, I think, important, is you cannot come into your precinct and just walk in. They're going to ask you, who are you going to vote for? And when you say, I'm going to vote for Elizabeth Warren or Joe Biden,
mm-hmm.
you have to vote for that person
initially
in the first round.
Okay.
You have to vote for that person.
Okay.
That means there is much more pressure for people to make a decision before they walk into the precinct.
Wow.
Because once they say, you know, Bernie Sanders, they've got to vote for Bernie. And then, of course, the question is, will Bernie be viable or not?
Okay, so let me stop you really quickly. So historically, let me just say, at the caucus, when you came in, you didn't have to declare the moment you walked in.
You did not.
And
nope,
therefore, nope, the conversation nope. that occurs in these caucuses, like kind of our group grope, means that people could say, you know, are you sure it's Bernie? Are you sure it's not Elizabeth? So they could actually do even the persuasion technique.
They would walk over to each other in those little groups and say, you don't want to support so-on. Come over, you know, and support, you know, Buttigieg or whatever.
Right, exactly.
That's still, I think, even I, the most informed professor about the caucuses, am not sure about this one, okay?
All right.
I think people can come in and say, I'm not sure who I'm voting for. So you can still have undecided groups.
So they can,
and
well, where,
I guess,
do they, where do they go? Do they go to the undecided corner, which
means
they're right
they for
the plucking?
They do. They
I
do.
Love
Jim,
it.
Jimmy Carter in 1976. Jimmy Carter was the one who set off the whole idea that the Iowa caucuses, you know, can make or break you as a candidate.
Right.
Jimmy Carter came in second to undeclared, undecided, undeclared.
He was second.
He wasn't first.
Wow.
So the other thing that my colleagues, we did this huge panel for 2 hours at the State Historical Building on the caucuses, the best political scientists on caucuses in the world, and me. I was somehow invited. I don't know. I guess they somehow
screwed up. Yeah, they were scraping the bottom of the barrel, I'm sure.
Yes.
All right,
and that's on C-SPAN. You can go look on C-SPAN.
Did.
It's terrific.
Yeah.
Interesting. But the other change is that in the past, the Democrats only reported delegate equivalencies. So that's an obscure number. Now, they also have to report the raw vote. In other words, what was the actual raw vote before they applied this magical mathematical formula?
Oh, wow.
And the problem is the results may be different.
What does that mean? In other words,
Amy Klobuchar may have won the raw vote, but after they put in this formula, she may come in second or third.
The media is going to be
freaked out because they're going to get the delegate equivalencies. And I think second, they're going to then get the raw vote. Now, my good colleagues more or less agreed that once the delegate equivalency vote of who ranked first, second, and third, and so on is reported, they're going to unplug their equipment and get on that airplane that they've chartered and fly to Manchester. And so it may be that on the night of the caucuses, you'll have a ranking of who won. But by the next morning, the media is going to start reporting, so-and-so, a different person, actually won the raw vote. It's going to be anarchy and chaos. I've told my Democratic friends, why don't you guys give up all that mumbo-jumbo and magic and, smoke and mirrors, and why don't you simplify the process so the voting is more transparent and simpler, and people can go to the caucus and they can talk to each other and do something and vote, and then they can go home quickly, because right now the caucuses in the Democratic Party often last 2 hours.
I know.
And it's 7 o'clock at night. And if it's like what's coming tomorrow in Iowa, a horrible, horrible cold weather and snow and freezing rain, it's just too tough on people.
Okay, so this is actually the perfect segue. So what I told my audience on TV last night was that there is also something different going on in the Iowa caucus this year. And what is different going on in the Iowa caucus is that 17-year-olds who will be turning 18 at the time of the November election will, for the first time ever, be able to participate in the Iowa caucus. Now, let me just say one more thing, because I've been reading about this, and that not only is that going to be interesting because it's going to bring a bunch of high schoolers who, no matter how bad the weather, will show up. Because they're not like that, like their grandparents or their parents going, oh, I got a shovel to get out and I don't know about the four-wheel drive. If they have a passion to come, they can cross-country ski to get there, but they have the physical ability to be there, number one. But number two, what someone told me was that the largest event going on in the entire state vis-a-vis the caucus happening in Iowa was when Greta Thunberg showed up in Iowa in the fall and young people on the whole issue of climate change came en masse. It was a huge, huge rally. And really part of the rationale for that huge, huge rally was not only to tell them to fight climate change, but to remind them that a lot of those 17-year-olds at that rally had the power to participate for the first time ever in the caucus. So tell me, has anyone been going into high schools around the state and monitoring whether these new seniors, these 17-year-olds, are actually going to take that power and use it in this caucus for the first time?
There has been some effort to engage high school students. Obviously, the civics teacher, government teacher, whoever, has an interest in making students become active citizens. And so they've been taking them. It's not difficult to take your students or have a candidate come somewhere and have your students meet that person face to face. So yes, there is going to be a small number, but Arnie, come on, 17-year-olds caucuses. Really?
I'm sorry, but if I'm going to exercise my power, I'm going to do it as soon as I can. If they're telling me it's 17,
Not everyone is Arnie Arneson.
All right.
But yes, that may make a difference. And from what we're seeing right now, the most fascinating thing is the younger people are going for the older candidates.
Yeah.
They're not supporting Mayor Pete, who is too young, and they go, do I want one of my classmates to be president?
No, that's not why they're not supporting Mayor Pete. It has nothing to do with his age. It has nothing to do with his age. It has to do with his agenda. And when you realize that agenda seems more tepid and more moderate, it ain't going to work. So before I let you go, though, because we do have we did have that debate.
Sleeper debate.
It was such an Iowa debate. And the reason, and you and I know why I say it was an Iowa debate.
Yes.
One,
yes.
Because we had this perception of Iowa nice. But the other reason why you didn't see anybody take off the gloves, I mean, Joe Biden went like he wasn't even on the stage, and yet he was on the stage, and nobody attacked him, even though he's still, depending on where you're looking and what poll you're looking at, number one or number two in the polls.
Yep.
And that is because in Iowa, you can be persuaded to choose another candidate. So therefore, during the debate, nobody really wants to take the gloves off because they know that that may not work well for them if it turns out that they may need the Buttigieg vote or they may need the Klobuchar vote. So therefore, it was almost by definition going to be boring.
Yes, it was. The gloves did come off, as
I
you
know. I know, but it came off at the very end.
I mean, the Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, and there was a CNN open mic, and Mr. Steyer, the businessman. It's the best graphic, the best picture I've seen. He's walking around, he looks like he's out of place, and he walks up to Bernie and Elizabeth Warren, and you can see his face dropping because they are in a fight over whether or not Bernie actually said that women can't get elected. It was fabulous. But it was stupid because, you know, the media loves those things. And, you know, it's a sad thing. It's all a spectacle. The media really does want to see blood. And it distracted so much.
And
I think it's now bad blood between those two.
And let me remind our audience that when, and I've said this before, and I want people to have it ingrained in their brain, that Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton had the highest negatives going into a presidential race of any two people running for president ever. The highest negatives. I want people to know that. So did, you know, even though Hillary got 3 million more votes than Donald Trump or whatever the number was, how many people didn't even vote? I was just listening to an interview in Michigan. This is incredible, everyone. So Donald Trump wins Michigan by, what, 11,000 votes? I mean, like a handful. All right? The size of a village, not the size of a city. So he wins by 11,000 votes. And then what I heard, and I'm pretty sure I'm accurate here, I think 200,000 people voted in that election and never chose a presidential candidate. Can you, 200,000 walked into an election in 2016 knowing that the most important thing for them to be showing up for was to vote for president and they never checked a box?
So who do you think this time, who do you think this time around is going to get those 200,000 people back to vote?
That is absolutely fascinating. And then the question becomes, was it because of the negative baggage that they kind of saw Hillary and Donald Trump as Tweedledum and Tweedledee because they didn't like either of them? And they decided, I'm not going to make a choice. I'm just going to walk out. Or I'm going to choose a third person. Or I'm not even going to show up to vote. I think the most important thing that every candidate should do is they should go into places like Michigan and Pennsylvania and Texas and whatever and explain to people who they are, why their vote matters, and why the consequences of not exercising that choice is not just about not getting perfection, but about basically undermining their future. And they have to make a choice, just like a jury has to make a choice. This is one thing where you're obligated to choose, and I'm not asking you to marry me. I'm not asking for perfection. What I'm saying is, this is why I'm better than what is sitting there today. Don't you think you have to do that?
It's true. Sadly, voter turnout in the United States compared to other democracies is very low every year. They never there's a huge percentage of people every presidential election who say, why can't we have better candidates, no matter who the candidates are? And so this was perhaps an exaggerated moment where,
terrible.
You know, Trump and Hillary Clinton were just disliked by a lot of people. But we have a problem, which is people, a large number of people are always disappointed.
Right. And I remember going into a town hall once saying, I'm not asking you to marry me. I'm not asking you to date me. I'm asking you to vote for me. And that's exactly how I began the conversation. And then I said to them, and this is why. And I'm going to disappoint you on some issues because I'm not a cookie cutter. And I'm not going to lie to you about everything. But if you play out what I'm going to do, here's the question. Are you better off? Are you better off? And that really is the conversation.
Do you think Donald Trump can ask people, are you better off now than than in 2016 when I got
He can
elected.
Ask the 1%. No. He can ask the 20% that are actually invested in the stock market whether they're better off, and then I will go and talk to the 80%. And I'm going to say to the 80%, so you're not better off. You don't have any money in the stock market. You're working three jobs. You can't afford your health care. You got student debt. Well, then guess what? You know, Donald Trump massaged the wealthy. I'm here to make sure the rest of the economy works for you. Why can't you say that?
I think that? Well, I think, you know, Mayor Pete is saying exactly that in the latest ad in Iowa. The problem is, and I talked to a bunch of statisticians, they said, well, you know, actually most people, in the unemployment rate in Iowa is below what it should be. I mean, it's so low that anyway, one of the candidates has a thing where he says, I promise to create 50,000 new jobs in Iowa.
We don't need
And my
them.
Wife says, you can create those jobs. There are no people here. We'd have to import Mexicans or somebody or people from Minnesota because we have full employment. And now the agricultural sector says, you see, Donald Trump renegotiated and everything is going to be okay. Yeah, and he's given us billions of dollars in bailout anyway. So we
I know.
Make it.
Welfare
so,
for
know,
farmers. Welfare for
right.
farmers. Let's remember, they hate welfare unless they're cutting the check. You know, I just want to remind everyone. All right, Stefan Schmidt, it's been a wild week between walking over the articles of impeachment, between the interview on MSNBC last night. Thank you for joining us. I really appreciate
it. Next week will be very calm.
Oh, yeah, right. All right, everyone. Thank you so much, Stefan. And we're going to end with Money is King. Well, totally appropriate for that conversation. How did that 1% do?
If a man has money today, people don't care if he has Coco Bay. If a man has money today, people don't care if he has Coco Bay. He can commit murder and get off free, live in the governor's company.